Kate V. entered OA in San Diego in 1984 and currently has 33 years of continuous abstinence from compulsive overeating. She served as chair, literature chair, and WSBC representative of the San Diego Intergroup, and currently serves as the WSBC and Region 1 rep for the Bitterroot Intergroup, which encompasses her hometown of Bozeman, Montana. Kate has lived in Bozeman for the past 14 years and has been fortunate to participate in OA with the Bozeman's dynamic recovery community. In addition to service at and above the group level, Kate's chief love is taking sponsees through the 12 steps and watching them transform. To that end, she has developed a format that she has presented at retreats in San Diego, California, and Calgary, Alberta, where she works all 12 steps with willing newcomers and other desperate compulsive overeaters in 30 days. After touching on her story, Kate will talk more about this 12-step method I introduced to you for this evening, Kate V.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Can everybody hear me? Is my mic on? Okay, great. Well, I'm Kate V, and I'm a grateful compulsive overeater from Bozeman, Montana, and delighted to be here in sunny Portland. You know, we love traveling in Bozeman, especially this time of year when we already had 6 inches of snow, and love is coming to places where there are palm trees and sunshine and joy in the streets. So it was quite a surprise to find that Portland is really Portland, you know. Well, I'm going to tell you for the first third of my time what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And that's the way we tell our stories, as you know. So I want to let you know just a few vignettes of what I was like. And I have a picture that I'm going to have circulated around. Could you, Tammy, could you just make sure that gets back to me? And just know that it's me holding a gigantic bone, I mean, with meat on it. Yeah, here I am, a vegan. This is taken when I was 20 years old. I was working at an alternative art institute, and the health department closed down our exhibit. So that's me dismantling the bone exhibit. My first memories of joy and happiness, and something that distinguished me from my brothers and sisters, we're a family of five kids, was that I knew where everything was in every cabinet of the house. My mother could never hide anything from me. I loved finding the vitamin C tablets in the top section of the shelf and eating them all. I got up in the middle of the night and grabbed handfuls of those like mini marshmallows, all the colored kind, and stuffed them under my bed, my pillow, and then I could sleep at night. I looked pretty much like a normal kid. I was very active and, you know, ran around and, you know, wanted nothing more than to hang out with my brothers, who wanted nothing more than to ditch me as soon as possible. So, next story that I remember very clearly was I was probably 10 to 15. My biggest love was to come home from school and have nothing to do, go into the dark basement, turn on the television set, even though it was kind of a fuzzy screen thing. My dad had taken gasoline across the plastic top of it, and anyway, you can imagine. And I would steal my brother's wrestling food, which was normally chocolate bars or anything, really, and have a glass of milk, turn off the lights, and watch television and eat, and not be anybody or anything, just alone. So to me, that, I mean, even now, I kind of have this nostalgic feeling, you know, about wanting to be all alone. But that may have to do with raising two boys. Now, then I, at 13, I started to diet because all the other girls dieted. And I was a swimmer, so I was pretty athletic. And the other girls weighed less than I did, always, like 10 pounds. And I hung out with these thinner girls. And so I wanted to diet, and I started investigating. And that's when I started to binge. Before, I just ate compulsively all the time whenever I wanted to. But the disease really accelerated when I started to restrict. So I went on all the crazy ones that girls go on. You know, the grapefruit and a hard-boiled egg diet that makes you want to faint on your bed before you get up too quickly. All the things you find in the stores, the grocery stores, that I could slip into my mom's cart before checkout. Magazines out of Red Book, you know, diets out of Red Book. And then I thought, I need to get serious about this. I need to go to Weight Watchers. So I went to Weight Watchers, and I lost a lot of weight for a while. And then I gained all the weight back. And then I went back, and this time it didn't work. So I was desperate. What do you do? I was 16 years old now, and I didn't look as cute in my little tennis outfit as I had once before. And I was really struggling. And the seriouser I got about the recovery from the illness, you know, recovering from being fat or overweight, the stranger and stranger my eating habits became. So I don't know many people who do the things that I did, but I would take a can of green beans and, you know, open the lid and eat the whole thing. You know, I would take any kind of food. I remember once I was in Weight Watchers and I was before weigh-in, and I really needed to eat because I needed to eat, you know, to feel. And I had no feelings. I just had the sensation of needing to eat. So I ate a jar of mustard. I mean, I don't know many people who binge on mustard, but I have been able to binge successfully on almost any food that comes my way. So fast forward a little bit. My father's an alcoholic, and he left our family when I was 19, and we've never seen him since. And so before this happened, there was a lot of tumultuousness. Do I think that I'm a compulsive overeater because I came from an alcoholic family? No. But it did exacerbate the disease. And I, in my senior year of high school, I was always a very goody two-shoes, good student, and showed up and did what I was supposed to. And in that year, I missed 40 days of school. And I gained probably 40 pounds. And this time, it was something different than it had been before. Because, you know, there's a point where when you wrap your clothes around, you can kind of fit into them. You can snug yourself in there. This time, the buttons would not engage. You know, I had no clothes. I'd grown out of things instantly. And, you know, people look at you kind of strange when one day you show up and you're 40 pounds heavier. And I remember what happened is I would take... My mother had sent me to some sort of behavior modification program. And they taught us how to take a food vacation, which meant that you packed a suitcase filled with food and put it under your bed. And one day a week, one day a month, you could eat anything in that suitcase, just as long as the next day you had all your food in Tupperware ready to go. Well, my food vacations grew in frequency so that I would go, you know, I was working because I was over 16, and I worked at a movie theater, and I had enough money so that I could go to 7-Eleven and buy big bags of food and eat them all in a parking lot in a neighboring school because I had ditched school. So I was in somebody else's park and slinked down in my station wagon, my 67 Chevrolet station wagon, 68, sorry, and eat and read Cosmopolitan magazine. And I did that all day long. So there's something wrong with this behavior. Also, I did have a 68 Chevrolet station wagon, and that was pretty big, and I could have taken a lot of people home. Did I ever give anyone a ride home? Never. And do you know why? Because I had so many candy wrappers under the seats. I couldn't ever let anybody into that car because it smelled like a hot chocolate factory. So, again, my mother's like freaking out. You know, she sends me to a therapist. I eat before I go to the therapist. I go to the therapist. I eat after I go to the therapist. And I give the therapist a lot of diet advice. I mean, really, really, that was me. So, I do remember, and then I get ready to go to college, and before I go to college, I get this job. I was like a hard worker, and I get this job, and I had to take a bus for some reason. And I remember sitting in the bus, you know, where, you know, the covered area where you pick up the bus, and dreaming about chocolate melted, flowing down my throat, you know, being covered with it. I mean, I was so obsessed that I couldn't stop thinking about eating, not eating, what my pant size was, what your pant size was, what kind of food you were carrying across over there. You know, I was obsessed. And I spent my very last money that I should have been saving for college on a medical weight loss program before I went to college. So I lost weight. Then I went to college, and I remember walking past the ice cream shop near campus and watching this kind of plumpish woman eating ice cream and thinking, oh my God, I'm so lucky that isn't me. Within weeks, I could not fit into any of the clothes I brought, and I had to go to the thrift store, and fortunately, ugly clothes were in, you know, work shirts, army pants, and because I had begun taking large bags of food, again, to distant corners of the campus and eating everything in that bag under a tree. Okay? So this was typical of my collegedom. The reason I think I survived college was because I began to smoke marijuana. I might have killed myself had I not done that. Now, it didn't last long because I was an art history major, and you must remember dates and paintings and faces. And this marijuana smoking was interfering with that. So I started smoking cigarettes instead. Isn't that a good choice? And by the time I left college, I was at the same weight as I come in. Did I compulsively overeat? Of course. But I'd given up on myself. I'd given up on dieting. So the binging had ceased a little bit. I was always really smart, though. I got jobs like working at the dining hall, guarding the door, and you'd get free food, you know, if you were in the dining hall. So, but I just let myself eat whatever I wanted to, and then I didn't have to binge. And so I had lost weight. I was still a compulsive overeater, still really no sensations of no feel. I couldn't say I feel angry, I feel happy, I feel sick. All I felt was hungry, and I didn't even have that feeling. All I had was the need to eat. So I got sent away on a scholarship, a fellowship, after I graduated to a foreign country for 3 years. And there I lived out in the countryside, doing some project with youth, and I would report back to Bangkok, or the main city, every month. And every month I came back, the women in the office would say, wow, you look different. You know, you look a little plumper. You know, the people that I lived with, it wasn't like a bad thing. It was just an honest thing. They would say, as a nickname, you'd be called Fat One. Or, you know, and so, and 1 month I'd come back and they'd say, you know, you look a little thinner. And so finally one of the women said, I think, have you ever investigated a disease called bulimia? And I thought, you're crazy lady. But the amount of dieting, the restricting, you know, it just became a way of life. And then I got sick. And I went home for a month, and they diagnosed me with something, and they put me on a special diet where I had to abstain from sugar and flour and white rice and potatoes and anything that, anyway. As soon as that happened, I came back to Thailand, and the first thing I did, I broke into a friend's house and sat down and ate an entire box of sugar cubes. Now, who does that? I mean, that has got to be the strangest thing. And so this is who I want you to get it, that I really am a compulsive overeater, because I have talked with people in our rooms who say, well, you must not be a compulsive overeater if you can do that. And I want to assure you that I was a hope to die compulsive overeater of the highest order and magnitude. I have done things that I never have heard of in the rooms. So I'm in Thailand, and it's my final year, and I'm sick. And my mother comes to Thailand and brings me home. Now, I'm 25. That's one of the most humiliating things that can happen to you, is having your mother come and bring you home. And she had moved from Seattle, where I was, had grown up, down to San Diego. I knew no one in San Diego. I had no friends. I slept on her floor with her in her boyfriend's apartment, and until she kicked me out. And all I had, she said, you need to go to OA. So she would take me to a meeting and drop me off. Here, go to the meeting. By this time, she had herself had gotten into a 12-step program. And so I came with a lot of hostility to Overeaters Anonymous, and a lot of, oh, it's so nice that you guys hold hands. I'm so glad for you that you can have this program. Isn't that sweet, you know, that you can pray? And I was like a really militant agnostic atheist. I would always get stuck with a fundamentalist Christian on the bus ride that lasted like 4 hours, you know. And I would see another American, and I would hide because I just didn't want to have the lecture. And so this all was very hard for me. I knew nobody. I weighed 201 pounds. I gained weight again in Thailand. I gained weight so quickly that I was giving lectures to people, and like my skirt would be ripping as I gave the lecture. And, you know, it's hard to find clothes in an Asian country when you're 200 pounds. It's just not, you just don't get it off the rack. So anyway, I came back, and I couldn't bear to face my pant size. So I wore muumuus. I had no car. I had $700 in my bank account. And I put up little posters around town saying, Kate cleans house. And I went and I cleaned people's houses. I lived in this dump, total dive in San Diego. They would rent out mansions, you know, and you get a room in this mansion. Well, this mansion probably had been condemned, or it should have been, and everybody inside of it should have been condemned as well. And this is the place I met my boyfriend. A practicing alcoholic, drug addict, and I was totally in love. So I was back in the United States a couple months, and I met the love of my life. And I'll tell you what, though, before I had come back to the United States, I had made like a New Year's resolution. And it's the closest I could have come to a prayer. I want to go home. I want to get well. I want to have warmth, a.k.a. I want a relationship. I'm lonely. And within 3 months, all those things had happened. So it gave me a little bit of an open mind to the idea of a higher power, of a force greater than myself. Because really, really, it was a hard thing to admit that I was not the sun. I wanted to be the sun. I did not want to be a planet or an asteroid or a meteorite going around the sun. So, but if you can imagine the perfect storm of horribleness, I'm in a city. My mother won't talk to me until I get a sponsor. I'm in a city. I don't know. I don't have a car. I'm riding a bike in muumuus. And it's San Diego. I don't know if you know San Diego, but you have to have a car in San Diego. And anyway, I'm cleaning houses. I'm sick. I have to go to the doctor twice a week. I'm a wreck. I'm having like rashes. And anyway, it's not a pretty picture. And I'm going to OA meetings where I really don't like the people. I don't want to be there. So it's like I have nothing. And I feel so blessed to have been put in that position, because that is, you know, I feel like I was in a pile of cow manure, and out of that grew something wonderful. And so I don't think I could have come to Overeaters Anonymous had I not been in the vortex of doom that I planted myself in San Diego. I was fired in quick succession by two sponsors. I tried many different food plans, and they were very similar to dieting for me. I mean, I'm not saying that they wouldn't work for other people, but because of my over-dieting, you know, I'd used up all credits and chits for dieting. I was crying to somebody who I thought was pretty much my equal. You know, she had gone to a good college. You know, I could talk to her, and she was my age. And so I thought, well, I could talk to her. And I was crying, and she said, would you like me to be your sponsor? And I said, yes. And the first thing she asked me to do, and I swear to God, this has saved my life. She said, I want you to take the first service position that comes open. So I became the Northminster Presbyterian Church's Monday night evening coffee maker. And now when you make coffee, you have to show up early, because that's a big pot. Like they have a big pot, and you have to show up early so it gets hot, and you have to stay late to clean it up. And you have to interact with people complaining, always complaining, compulsive eating and coffee and tea and hot chocolate, whatever, if there's a complaint. You always have to talk to people. So from there on, I started to have a more open mind. People started to bump into me. I started to talk to people. And then I started to read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and something magical happened. I remember I read the third step prayer, and I thought, oh my God, could this really be true? Could it really happen for me like this? And then, you know, because I had this lovely boyfriend, I had gotten a car by this time, a $500 car with no spare tire. And he would borrow my car, and we'd be going out somewhere. He'd say, let me drop you off at the park. I'll be back in 20 minutes. 5 hours later, he would come back and pick me up, because he had been scoring somewhere. And so I was angry all the time. And that's when I learned how to do a fifth step. In the beginning, I just did them because it felt good. And that's why I was able to continue working the steps, because what I did felt good. Now, I have to say something very unpopular here. I did not understand how to eat at this point. I don't think my sponsor understood how to eat at this point. It was 1985. I don't know if you guys remember what was going on in the mid-80s, but there was a lot of like, oh, just don't eat compulsively. And so that's what we were doing, just not eating compulsively. Well, what does that mean? We didn't know. Okay, really, we didn't know. I worked the steps, and I was very thorough, because I was the kind of guilty conscience person. So my resentment inventory was 85 pages long. I mean, I was 25. How can you have 85 pages when you're 25 years old? So I worked the steps, and as I progressed, I got better. And I got better, and I said to this boyfriend, you know, it's really a drag. You're lying to me. Something's going on, and you know, I'm going to leave, so I can't be around you anymore. And I'll say more about this in my relationship workshop tomorrow, but he asked if I would drop him out at Narcotics Anonymous meeting, and I did. And I just let him stay there, and he found a ride home. And he came home and told me he was a heroin addict. And this is the man who I've been married to for over 30 years now. So that's pretty magic. So eventually I become eager to sponsor other people, because I know it all. And I, 20 minutes. Already? 20? Okay. Because I know it all. And so I start sponsoring, and those poor people who I sponsored, I have no idea whatever happened to them, but I listened and I gave my advice, and that's where I really, really, what is it called? I I really broke my teeth on that, those people. Those people were important to me because I had to learn how to become a sponsor. It took a long time, and it took a long time to know that the less I said, the better it worked out. So I'm going to fast forward through this. I do want to touch on one thing. I've been in program. In December, it will be 34 years of continuous abstinence. Thank you very much. And God bless. God bless you. And during that time, I have been challenged. In 14, 15 years of abstinence, I came down with major depression that left me on the couch for 2 years. I didn't have to compulsively eat, but I did have to learn a different way to live. My sister relapsed in her alcoholism, and we took her son for 2 years. That was one of the biggest challenges of my life, and I learned that I wasn't a very nice person. This poor boy was 5 years old, and I had vicious thoughts about him all the time. And then my mother became ill, and I had to go to the hospital with her. One year it was 4 times, 10 days each, the Mayo Clinic. And then she asked us to move to Montana. We were living in San Diego, and so I moved to Montana. And as soon as I moved to Montana, my mother began to write nasty letters about my husband and I to my other relatives. Life is not pretty. I mean, it rains on the just and the unjust alike. But I want to tell you, the good news here is that I never felt the need to compulsively overeat again. No matter what bad thing happened to me, I never felt the need to compulsively eat again. And I have 2 grown sons, and you know that I have had some bad experiences. Just let me tell you. Okay, so one of my passions is sponsoring. And I just want you to get the idea of Brad Pitt, okay? Remember in A River Runs Through It? He's a fly fisherman, and his dad has taught him the rhythm of fly fishing. And near the end of the movie, even though this guy's a total drunk, gonna die kind of guy, we see him in his moment of glory when he learns how to whip that rod to his own rhythm. Okay? And that's how I feel about sponsorship now. When I was in my early days, I tried to do exactly what my sponsor taught me to do. And now, that's out the window. I am just trying to see what works best. And again, you know, this last couple of years, I've taken on a lot of newcomers just to try out my methods. It's like, oh, goody, another newcomer. And what I've noticed is that it's really important to get people when they're desperate. Because once they lose their desperation, inertia sets in and they move pretty slowly through steps. You know, step 4 can take them a year. You know, step 4 in my book is like half a week, you know, or maybe over the weekend too. So I developed this little plan of how I work the steps in 30 days. And I really want people to have a spiritual experience, not to complete assignments, okay? And compulsive overeaters are very good at completing assignments. We love assignments. It gives us a sense of completion and like, oh, I did my job. But what we're aiming for is that moment of clarity in which we fully understand that we are not the sun, that we are less than a meteorite in the big universe, and that we need to just accept the universe that we've come into. So, first thing we do is we read more about alcoholism. And my very favorite story is Jim's story, okay? Because in that story, we learn that we're screwed to the wall. We are beyond human aid, that we have this weird mental blank spot that prevents us from remembering that we have a problem, we have a disease, and we think it's okay to pour some whiskey into milk and drink it. We think it's okay. Oh, yeah, that woman and made those cookies specially for me. I better eat one. You know, we don't rise to our ages and say, you know, we're like middle-aged people, and we don't say, oh, thank you so much, but I don't want one. Thank you. Thank you so much. That was so kind of you, but I'm full. Now I say, thank you so much, but I don't eat in between planned meals. You know, I just eat meals. I don't snack. So, love that story. And I read it out loud with the people I sponsor. Then we go to step two, and they get a really hard assignment. And their assignment is to call three other compulsive overeaters and ask them what their higher power is to them, what it looks like, what it feels like, what it does for them. This is a very difficult assignment for them. They don't, the phone is like a 50 pound weight, you know, they just can't, it's very difficult. But I tell them we can't proceed until they make those calls. And then we get to step three. And this is the most exciting step for me because, you know, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. Well, what does that mean? We make a decision to turn our, what does turning our will look like? How do I behave? So I go to page 60, right after the, you know, thing we used to read all the time at the beginning of our meetings, the A, B, and C. And I want to read this to you, how I ask them to read it to themselves for the remainder of the week and over the weekend. The first requirement is that I be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, I am almost always in collusion with something or somebody, even though my motives are good. I try to live by self-propulsion. I am like an actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players my own way. So they read this out loud through till page, the middle of page 63 to themselves every day. And then I ask them to count how many times they think they're selfish during the day. So, selfish, in our definition of selfish, means it's not going according to my script. You are not behaving the way I want you to behave. No, that's just not okay in my world. No, I don't like that. I wish it were different. It shouldn't be that way. The truth is, it is that way, right? And once we accept the reality of the way it is, then we can face the situation realistically, like, oh, he's going to run me over. I think I'll get out of the street. Or anyway, this is a very important assignment to me. Selfishness, understanding selfishness is probably the biggest thing that ever happened to me and made me such a happy person after I understood it. Before I understood selfishness, I would go to Target and they would not accept a check because I'd never written a check there. And I would have to take it up with the management. And then I would have to call my credit card people and tell them something. And I would have to, I mean, I would terrorize these poor people because they weren't doing things the way I thought they should. Or I would go to a store. And in my mind now, everyone who works in a store is 18 years old. And you ask them for the cat food or where's the dog food? And they say, I don't know. And I think, gosh, that's not how you run a business. And blah, 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 blah. So, with selfishness, you say, oh, they don't know. Okay. Then you find somebody who does know. Or you just decide to go to a different store. Life is so much easier once you don't have to insist that the world behave the way you think they should. And I don't know. It took me like 25 years to get this, really. But I'm a much happier person as a result of it. And I don't have to embarrass myself all the time in public, you know. Or I have a much happier marriage because my husband doesn't have to behave the way I want him to. Because the truth is, people rarely behave the way I want them to. And I can go around being very unhappy, or I can accept that and roll with it and deal with the reality of the situation. Not, oh, they shouldn't, they shouldn't, they shouldn't. If I keep doing that, I'm never going to get to, well, they are, and now what? And now what? Very important with my children. Especially my 21-year-old son. You know, I actively practice, I do something called active ignoring because I can't change him. I can't do anything. So I just try to ignore it and focus on myself because my peace of mind, my serenity, my abstinence are so much more valuable than useless worry. Okay, so that's step three. And I love step three because it shows people what it is to not be selfish. And that is really what turning our will and our lives over to the care of God. We begin to accept reality as it is and then make good decisions based on that reality. That is what turning our will and our lives over to the care of God is. Now, steps 4 through 9 are going to be talked about, I'm sure, tomorrow by our illustrious speaker, Larry. And I have a ton of forms, and I have my whole workshop. And if you want me to send it to you, I can. All you have to do is give me your email address, and I will send you the whole 20 pages of outline and forms in the mail. Needless to say, I try to go through these very quickly, okay? I try to go through them very quickly, and when I do a fifth step with someone, I know some people abbreviate fifth steps, but I think a fifth step is kind of like a marriage. You have to make a big deal about it because it's a big deal. So I go over to their house. I say, I'll come to your house. You fix me lunch because I want to see what they're eating and how they're eating. You fix me lunch and then we'll try to get it done in one day. And usually it's all day long. And then I leave them alone for an hour. I ask them to consider if there's more they need to tell me. And sometimes when I come back, they do tell me more. Sometimes they don't. And then we say the 7-step prayer, and they are off on their 8th step. So it's as quick as that. It's as quick as that. And I'm happy to meet them anytime. During this first 30 days, I speak to them for an hour, Monday through Friday. We read together, and we evaluate their assignments together. There, again, there's one assignment per step. It's not a lot, but I'm trying to play on their desperation and get them through these steps, because if we are to believe Jim's story, the only way that we are free from this disease, the only thing that puts us into that lovely neutral status is working the steps, right? So when we begin to complain about our eating and think we need to release some food or something, really, are you working your 10th, 11th, and 12th steps? Are you doing the steps? If you are, we'll talk about the food. But if you're not, let's talk about the steps. That's my deal. So I work very intensively, and if they need to meet me, if they have a question, I'm open to it. And this is a very exciting time for me. I feel like I'm passionate. I mean, it's like having a child, you know, you just love them so much. You love these people, and if they're with you, you're with them. You're in this big quest together. So that's why I get a lot out of it personally, and I let them know. And I feel like we build a sense of trust that lasts for many years. Okay, so now we go on to step 9. They're writing, you know, they've gotten their list, and they're beginning to make their amends. I want you to know that the big book says it's okay to start on your 10th step while you're working on your 11th step. It's okay. In fact, you should do that. And that's what I do. So they do a 10th step every day with me, for 5 days. So I want to demonstrate what that looks like. Okay. I'm going to need a volunteer from the audience. Let's take you. Come on right up front. Okay, there are several kinds of 10 steps, all right? We're always supposed to be on the lookout for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear, okay? So I'm going to show you, do you have a resentment or a fear?
A fear.
Okay, hang on just a second. I've got my phone. You're going to call me. Not really. Why don't you come on up here? We'll be close. These 10 steps should be done. They take 2 minutes if you know how to do them. And they're quick. And they for me, they happen all day long if I need to. Now I usually don't need to do them all day long. I can catch my selfishness pretty quick and my dishonesty And if it doesn't linger longer than a couple seconds, I don't make a big deal about it, but I catch it. So we're going to work on a fear 10 step here. I just want to demonstrate it to you because it's a lovely thing to watch someone go through this and be able to release it. And it may take a while before people get used to this way of you know, talking to people and releasing their fears, but it's what keeps us in neutrality. I mean, really the 10th step promise is that we will be placed in a safe and neutral place. So, tell me, what are you afraid of? Speak into the mic, please.
I'm afraid of saying the wrong thing to my children.
Okay, and why are you afraid of that?
Because I quite often do. And I get in a lot of trouble from them. They give me a really hard time about what I've said.
Okay. So are you relying on yourself or are you relying on God?
Myself.
How's that working for you?
Not well.
Okay. I would like you to repeat after me. God.
God.
Please remove this fear.
Please remove this fear.
And show me what you would have me be instead.
Show me what you would have me be instead.
Very good. Okay, now I want you to imagine what God would have you be instead of being afraid. Speak right into the mic. What do you think?
Confident.
Okay.
He would put the words into me. I would know what I was supposed to say.
And would you be afraid that they would leave you or something bad would happen if you said the wrong thing? Or would you, like if you were talking to your child, would you say that, well, mistakes are essential, you know, things happen? What would you say? How would you be about this? Would you be as self-critical?
Probably not. I think I would just say, oops, I've done it again.
Perfect.
Let's carry on.
That's perfect. Now, a round of applause. Thank you so much. A fear 10 step is that easy. 2 minutes. And once you begin with the vocabulary and the sense of it and the rhythm, it begins to feel like second nature. And really, we work steps 1 through 9 so that we can learn how to do steps 10, 11, and 12. Because that's how we're supposed to live. 10, 11, and 12. Okay, I need a resentment. A good, juicy resentment. Oh, Tammy. Tammy, the illustrious Tammy from Tacoma. Okay, Tammy. I'm going to, we're not talking on the phone right now. Okay. Call me up.
Do we need a backstory on this?
No backstory.
Okay. My mother.
Okay. That doesn't work very well. Tammy, you're resentful at your mother. Why?
My mother has relied on me her entire life. And now as she's gotten older, we had to put her into a nursing home. And when she needs me the most, I'm used up.
Okay, so you're resentful because she's asking you to do stuff that you don't have the energy to do. Is that it?
Correct.
Okay, good. So this is what is this affecting? Your security maybe, your self-esteem, your ambitions? What is this affecting? Personal relations?
It affects my entire life. It's always there in the back of my mind. It's a lot of guilt. Am I doing enough? Am I being a good daughter?
Okay, thank you. Stop them if they start to go into it, all right? So tell me where you're being selfish, where you want your way, where it's not going according to your script. Tell me that. Tell me about your selfishness.
I don't want to do it.
Do you not want it to be happening?
Yes. I I don't like this phase in my life, and I don't want it happening.
So you don't want to be the daughter who has a sick mom right now, and you don't want to feel this much responsibility. So it shouldn't be this way.
Correct.
Okay.
I there's other people in my family, and they all just turn their backs, and it's me. Okay. Only me.
Okay. Good. You hear that selfishness? It shouldn't be. I mean, we can be selfish. I am selfish because I wish I were thinner. You know, I wish my body were different. I wish God had given me a different body. That's selfishness. I wish things were different. Okay, and you heard it here. Even these noble selfishness things are selfishness. We're not saying, oh, you're a bad person because you're selfish. We're just saying, facts are, you're selfish here. Okay, dishonest. How are you being dishonest?
Maybe it's because I'm convincing myself that there's nothing, there's no one else but me. The other thing that I find myself doing is telling stories about my mom. Maybe this is more building up my own ego. Telling stories about my mom and sharing what a wonderful daughter I am.
So it's Tammy from Tacoma, the virtuous daughter.
Yes, that's the whole old correct full name.
Okay. Tammy, are you doing things that you are not asked to do? Are you doing above and beyond what is called for in this situation?
Yes, I'm reading her mind. I'm doing what she asked, but I'm always one step ahead in thinking what she needs.
Okay. Do you see that dishonesty? You see that dishonesty? She's doing more because she thinks she should be doing more, but it's not really required of her. Okay, so let's move on. Self-seeking. Now, what is self-seeking? Self-seeking is manipulating to get your way. It means saying something or doing something to get your way. It means not saying something or not doing something because you don't want people to be mad at you, or you don't want to feel bad, or you look mad. It's manipulation, okay? An action, whereas selfishness is a thought. Okay, where are you being self-seeking?
There's the one where I'm telling people and trying to build myself up and showing that I'm doing it all.
Okay. Are you asking people for help? And are you asking your mother, like, do you want this done, Mom? Or are you being straightforward with her? And or are you just doing things that are expedient for you? To make it easier on you.
No, this is not any easier on me. I go into autopilot and just do one step at a time and the next best action that I can think of. And as I said that, I'm like, uh-oh, where's God?
Ah, so, okay, so it's Tammy's way, not God's way. All right.
Tammy from Tacoma.
Excuse me. Thank you, Tammy.
No problem.
Okay, now let's go on to the big one, fear. Where are you afraid here?
I'm afraid that I will be judged by not doing enough. I am. I'm afraid that my mom is going to die, and that I will never have told her that I love her.
Because you're so pissed off at her.
Yep.
Okay, good. Okay, that's great. Do you hear that great fear? I mean, that's what we're looking for here, guys. That's what we're looking for. Next thing she'll be doing is stripping for you here.
That costs extra.
Okay, so now we're going to do the seven-step prayer. Because we've identified a resentment and character defects. Which I have four character defects that rule my life. Selfishness, dishonesty, self-seeking, and fear. Those are my four character defects. So, repeat after me. My Creator.
My Creator.
I am now willing that you should have all of me good and bad.
I am now willing that you should have all of me good and bad.
I pray that you now remove from me this resentment.
I pray now that you remove this resentment
and all its associated defects of character
that
stand in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows.
Split that in half. That stand in the way
of my usefulness to you and my fellows.
Grant
me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen.
Amen.
Okay, are we done? No.
Oh, I know this one.
Okay, so now we go on. And this is a really important thing. Are there any amends to be made?
In my mind, I see that if anything, I owe an amends to myself. And what I can do for my mom would be a living amends.
So you do it a living amends and maybe not be so directive about her care. Maybe let her have a little bit more hands. Do you think that's what you're talking about?
Mm-hmm. Yes, okay. Kate, you're right.
Okay, good. You see that? Isn't that great? Okay, now this is the really important part. We resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Now, what does this mean? Well, it could mean that your husband usually does the laundry and he has a load of laundry in there and you change it from the washer to the dryer. Or it means that the garbage man came that day and there's trash all over the street. You go out and pick up that trash. Or you're walking down the sidewalk and there's dog poop and you have a dog poop bag in your hand. You know, it could be that you call a newcomer in OA. It could be that you've been meaning to call somebody in OA that you haven't seen and you call them. So Tammy, how are you going to be useful and helpful today to someone?
Kate, do you need me to pass out those bookmarks you have on the table?
Yes, thank you so much.
No problem.
Okay, thank you so much. Okay, so this last part is something that's critical because we're like small children, must distract ourselves to something useful, okay? We must get out of the head throbbing with emotion and tension and do something useful for somebody else. And that gets us back into perspective. This was a hard one because this was a very serious issue. Most of the time, people are pissed off that their husbands didn't pick up their socks, okay? And they're calling me. And I'm, great, you know? And also, if I call somebody, they don't have to leave me. I've done this a zillion times. I have actually given a 10-step to a woman with a crying, screaming kid in the background who says, okay, okay, great. You know, so the point is that we reach out, we find our part, we make amends if we need to, and we resolutely turn our thoughts to helping somebody else. That's a really important part. Okay, so this 10th step with the, you're getting a yellow card. Unfortunately, Tammy's also passing out the green cards, so hang on to those too. But the yellow card is really useful. I keep it in my calendar as a bookmark. So when I'm selfish or dishonest, I go through this really quickly. And this comes straight out of the big book. And it is, we continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment and fear. So dishonesty and selfishness are easy. You catch those. God, please remove that from me. Contact somebody else immediately. You make amends if you need to. And the last part is resolutely turn your thoughts to helping somebody else. It's as quick as that. But you do probably need to call somebody and say, yeah, you know, they gave me like an extra $5 cash and I didn't take it back. Well, you need to take that back. Or, you know, I wasn't really truthful with my friend when I said, you know, blah, blah, blah. So talking it over with somebody else is that getting in that habit of reaching out and asking for help. And we need to do that a lot. Okay, how many minutes do I have left? Okay, thank you. So I'm going to, is there anybody who has a question for me right now about this 10th step? Does this seem unusual to you, or have you seen this method before? Great. Good job. Now I'd like to move on to the 11th step. And in our big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I like the big book because there wasn't a 12 and 12 when I first came into Overeaters Anonymous, and I kind of fell in love with my big book, and I've gone through many copies, and they're torn apart and marked up horribly. So the 11th step, meditation back in the 30s was not our good om, follow your breath, follow a candle meditation, which I support people doing. Really, I do. But what the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about is getting up in the morning. Oh, can I have one of those? Thank you. To the green. Thank you. Getting up in the morning and asking God some questions before we start our day. And we had a retreat leader who was fabulous, Mary Works, who went through the big book and found all the prayers that we need to ask for every day. And so she compiled them, and I compiled them on this bookmark. And so this is what I do. I'm not saying you have to do this, but this is what I do every morning when I'm working my program. Okay. There are mornings when I do not work my program, and I have a shitty day. Okay, before considering my plans for the 24 hours ahead, God, please direct my thinking, especially that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonesty, or self-seeking motives. If I face indecision as I think about my day, God, please give me an inspiration, an intuitive thought, or a decision. Help me to relax and take it easy, not to struggle, to trust that the right answer will come. This is the good part for me. Reveal to me what I can do for the person who is still sick today. Show me the way of patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love. And when you ask for patience, that is an act of faith, because you will definitely be behind a woman with 85 coupons in the grocery store, and you will get to practice that. So this is a really big act of faith. If you believe in your higher power and you ask for patience, congratulations, you are a brave person. So then I open up my calendar and I look at my day. And this is, I'm a person who is constantly disappointed because I have like 25 things I want to do, and really I only have time for 3. So every day I would go home and feel disappointed in myself. So when I learned how to do this, I started to time block out things. What's most important, during the week I put my meetings in first, the people I sponsor in first, my exercise, because I am a exercise-averse person who really needs to put it in much higher priority. And then I conclude. After I feel out and I really get clear on what I really can do that day, and I think, oh, yeah, it's so much less than I thought, then I say, as I conclude this period of meditation, God, please show me all through the day what my next step is to be. Give me whatever I need to take care of presumptions that lead to absurd actions and ideas. Now, you may not find that in the big book because it just says, please take care of my problems. But I think the problems they were talking about were the presumptions that lead to absurd actions and ideas. You figure it out yourself. If you want something different, you put it in there. But that, to me, is what it said. Please grant me freedom from self-will and let me remember to make no requests for myself only. Help me to carry your vision into all my activities. Show me how I can best serve you. Your will, not mine, be done. When agitated or doubtful, remind me to pause and ask for the right thought or action. Help me to remember that I am no longer running the show. Your will be done. Your will be done. Okay, why do I have to say this? Because I still have a problem being less than an asteroid. You know, I really need the repetition to remind me who's in charge here. And some days I totally forget it. So this is a good way to start my day. And, you know, I'm sitting there and I have to admit, I want to tell you that Dr. Addict Alcoholic, I know it's called something different now in the big book. It's a story about an alcoholic guy who was married to a woman named Max. And every day he brought Max her coffee. And I thought, that is a really good idea. So I said to my husband, you know, honey, I would just love a cup of tea in the morning. And so every day he brings me a cup of tea and I do my meditation during that time. So I just think it's a special time. You can read other books. Sometimes I read other books. Sometimes I do other things, depending on how I'm feeling. But I must do this if I'm working my program. Okay. So the last thing, well, one of the last things I want to tell you, no, I have plenty of time. Very good. Okay. Is that the nightly 11th step. It's outlined in our books. And I have, I don't think I have enough. Those ones. Yeah.
Did you? Extra, enroll, yellow screens, or white.
I have also passed out. You know, I missed the deadline on copying, so it was on me to copy, and so I only copied 100 of the spiritual toolkit ones. Just, can you raise your hand if you're familiar with the spiritual toolkit, the OA spiritual toolkit? Okay, good. I'm glad. I love using that spiritual toolkit, and my sponsor loves it too. At night, doing the nightly inventory, because it asks the exact same questions as our big book asks. And when I send it to my sponsor, she feels closer to me. She feels closer and we connect. I speak to her every week, but we feel close. And I feel close to people who give it to me. And I love them giving it to me. It's really funny oftentimes. Because we have such gothic fears, you know, and tragic resentments. And when we put them on paper, they are hysterical, you know. And so this is a very important process. And I like to ask myself the questions. It's the questions that I need to ask myself every day. Hang on just a second while I look it up. Well, let me just pull it up here. There we go. Okay, I'm going to pull up somebody's who sends me lovely ones. Okay, they're just great. This woman has given me permission to use her 11th step. And she's wonderful because she has two children, young children. One of them is a special needs kid. So you know her life is chaotic. And it's wonderful to receive these resentment inventory or these 11 steps. Okay, so when we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Were we resentful? This makes it so easy. We just, you know, push the button, yes or no. And she said, yes. Husband asking me to take the dog out before bed and then grumpy when I don't. Asked after having lots of time to himself. Two meetings out with a friend, not home for dinner, etc. It was my birthday, acting secretly resentful, not like another bout of responsibility-induced grumpiness is coming on. Okay. Wonderful stuff. This is great. Were we selfish? Yes. I want him to act differently to make me comfortable. Were we dishonest? Yes. I told him it was fine to go out with a friend because I didn't want to cook anyway. I wanted more of a fuss for my birthday, and it didn't occur to me to schedule a solo outing for myself. Beautiful. Were we afraid? Yes, afraid of arguments, afraid not to go to Seattle this weekend, even though I don't want to, and the trip home, and the trip home weather looks bad. Afraid of grumpy ex, and her present husband, who won't get breaks from children. Afraid it's the wrong choice medically to postpone till spring. Afraid I'm just being selfish, wanting to skip the hassle. Afraid if I go, husband will think I'm going because ex-husband wants me to. Lovely stuff. I mean, could you ask for a better nighttime reading? Do we owe an apology? No. She didn't say anything. This is a lovely, lovely person. You would never guess these thoughts were going on in her mind. And she must do this because... given her family situation, her ability to give a lot of service is limited. And doing this 11th step keeps her in touch with our program. Okay. Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person at once? No. Just clearly need an Al-Anon meeting. Holy codependency issues, like I was afraid to make a thing of my birthday because My husband, we were on the road back from Oregon, and his sucked, so I wasn't allowed a good one in my mind. I have a lot of fear that his big resentment will come around again, and it will be all about me. That's her fear. She said no at first, and then she changed her mind. Were we kind and loving towards all? Her answer was yes. So she had all of these really negative thoughts, and her behavior was kind and loving. What could we have done better? Should have made time for some selfish birthday fun. Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time? Yes. My answer is, of course. Or were we thinking of what we could do for others, of what we could pack into the stream of life? And she has yes, but she didn't explain. And what I want to tell you is you don't have to answer every question. I like to tell people, give yourself 5 minutes and just ask those questions until something grabs on. And then start answering and answer as much as you want to and then send it out. Well, the important thing is that we keep asking ourselves these questions every day. So because we have this forgetting problem, you know, we think it's okay to put whiskey in our milk. So that's the 11th step. And I think it's great. And I think that my spiritual toolkit, it's my OA toolkit. It's specialized for OA. You can send your eating, you can send writing to your sponsor. There's a way to email it. It's great. Or you can text it. I don't make any money from this program, by the way. Now I want to go to the 12th step very quickly. The 12th step has saved my life because I am a person who needs to do more service than is comfortable. And I always have. And when I was young, because I came in when I was 25, I was captured by a group of people who kidnapped me and held me in service. And I was with a group of women. We started a recovery home for women with eating disorders. We knew nothing. I think I had 6 months. You know, we were throwing garage sales. We had a garage sale in which we had to sleep out overnight because we didn't want anybody to steal our good stuff. And we opened the house from that garage sale. So I probably worked 20 hours a week on that little project. And although it was a separate entity, it felt like OA. You know, we had OA meetings there. We were involved in service all the time. We had to serve on the board. It was exhausting and wonderful. And I got close to a group of people who were like-minded. And I learned that every meeting I go to, it's really pretty good to do a service job at that meeting because, you know what, I get my bottom into that chair. And how hard is it to count the money while you're at the meeting? I really never count the money outside of the meeting, or I do all of my service at the meeting. And again, sponsoring, I sit around this room of women that I've sponsored, and some men, because we don't have male sponsors. You know, there's not a lot of men. And I experience love when I had my children. That kind of love just seeps into my body when I listen to other people share and I know where they've come from. And some of these people are detested by others of these people. You know, they're, terrible behavior, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I just love her because, you know, I know everything about her. I was her. You know, we have a woman who used to come into our meetings and complain about them starting late, but she was always 20 minutes late. You know, this was not a popular person. I loved this woman. So I get what people get from running, from sponsoring people, that sense of belonging and well-being, and I get that endorphin rush from sponsoring people. And not everybody's going to get that. So we each have to learn how to be the fly fisherman and get our own rhythm, find our own way, and start going. And I think it's fine to sponsor the way that your sponsor has sponsored before, but I say take a risk, you know, if you can. If you feel confident enough, take a risk. Try something new. Try something experimental. And also, the big book, you know, when Mary Works was leading our retreat, she went into the working with others chapter, and it was like horrifying. You know, go to the person's wife, find out as much as you can about the person. I'm like, oh my God, I could never do that. But really, truthfully, it's really important. I have learned more about Christianity, Buddhism, atheism, all sorts of things, because I need to communicate with the people I sponsor. I'm willing to learn anything. You tell me, I'm going to learn it, because I want to connect with you, because this is going to save your life. You may not know that, but it's going to save your life. I do have to put this caveat in. Very few people who are not at their lowest of low desperate places ask me to sponsor them. In fact, they sit way across the other side of the room, try to avoid eye contact. They cry, you know. Sometimes when people, I always ask them, the first thing I say, are you desperate? Are you willing to go to any lengths? And they'll say, yeah. I say, good, because I may ask you to go to any lengths, you know, and I mean it. And if they're not at that place, I've told people, it's okay. You know, that's okay. There's plenty of really fine sponsors here. Go ahead. And then they call me back 3 months later, crying, desperate, wanting it. And they're willing to go through it quickly. And they're willing to, something just unfolds in them. And to me, watching that unfolding, there couldn't be anything better. I mean, I don't tell my husband I said that, but there couldn't be anything better for me. That I feel like really in my OA meetings and with my OA friends, I am my best, you know? And I am so grateful to be around people who I feel good around. And I owe my recovery to their recovery and to everybody's recovery. I mean, I'm just so grateful that I don't know how it happened to me. I was not the most likely person to succeed. You would have looked at me and said, she's not making it. And here I am, 33 and a half years later. And so I'm very blessed. I'm very lucky. And thank you so much for being here and listening to me.